It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer.
First, in a recent interview with ABC News, United States Attorney General Eric Holder said the Department of Justice is expected to get involved in two court challenges involving states and voter ID laws, including one here in Wisconsin.
The Justice Department has already intervened in similar cases challenging voting laws in Texas and North Carolina. With Wisconsin expected to join that list, there's been a lot of speculation as to what could happen and when it might happen.
Here to talk about this story is Wisconsin Public Radio state government reporter Sean Johnson. Sean, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what do we know so far about the possible DOJ involvement in Wisconsin's battle over voter ID here?
Not too much. I mean, it's something that Eric Holder just mentioned in passing in that ABC News interview that you referenced there. ABC News talked about it a little bit in their reporting, and then in a transcript of the interview that was released by the U.S. Department of Justice, Holder said, quote, "We have already filed suit in Texas and North Carolina. I expect we're going to be filing in cases that are already in existence in Wisconsin as well as in Ohio." So that's about the extent that we know about it, although we have heard Eric Holder mention Wisconsin in recent weeks, too. He had a video message on the DOJ website that singled out Wisconsin and the federal lawsuit in Wisconsin that put Wisconsin's voter ID law on hold for now.
And if he were to go forward with this, on what grounds can he file a lawsuit or move forward with this?
Well, that particular lawsuit that he's referencing struck down Wisconsin's law based on a couple of factors. On the grounds that it violated the U.S. Constitution's Equal Protection Clause and that it violated Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The Section 2 challenge was kind of groundbreaking when it comes to how lawsuits have attacked voting laws like the one in Wisconsin. And that's a section of the Voting Rights Act that prohibits voting practices that discriminate on the basis of race. Traditionally, the Department of Justice, you know, under Holder and under previous attorneys general, would enforce voting laws in southern states in particular using other sections of the Voting Rights Act. But when Section 4 of the Act was struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court, kind of left people wondering, left the Department of Justice wondering how they would, exercise authority in the future. Seems like from Eric Holder's comments that they like what they've seen with the Wisconsin lawsuit and they might be joining it.
Yeah, definitely a lot of layers to this discussion. And at the same time, there's been some response, at least from our state attorney general, J.B. Van Hollen. What did he say?
Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, in a written statement, said that he referenced a lot of the news regarding immigration that's going on at the national front right now, said, quote, "Maybe Mr. Holder should take his army of lawyers and start enforcing our nation's immigration laws." Attorney General Van Hollen went on to say, quote, "At a time when an immigration crisis is rattling the nation, the attorney general is choosing to spend taxpayer money to meddle in a state law that does nothing more than ask a voter to show a photo ID." So general on general violence there. We've got taking aim at each other.
Well, and that last statement stood out to me, too. So as AG Van Hollen put it, we're simply asking people to present an ID when they vote. Seems very simple and straightforward. And yet the dialogue around the issue has extended to voting rights and to the possibility of racial discrimination, as pointed out by Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. How did it evolve to get to be such a large issue here?
I think it's been a large issue for a while now. This is something that Republicans have pushed for quite a while. They came to power in 2011, and it was one of the first bills that they passed after the battle over Act 10, and it was very quickly blocked by state courts. A couple Dane County judges blocked voter ID. This federal lawsuit took longer to proceed, but it's a big one, and it's now in the hands of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in Chicago. And I think what it really, what the issue really boils down to is, at least in this lawsuit, the way that they've framed it, is that the state, in this case, Republican lawmakers and the governor, have not been able to point to cases of voter fraud that would be remedied by a voter ID law. And so they contend there's not there's no grounds for having a law like this when statistics have shown that it's going to, you know, it's going to drive down turnout. It's going to make it hard for some people to get those IDs. And, you know, in practice, they're not going to get them. So that's sort of the argument going forward. And there have been some signs that the appeals court, at least one of the judges on the appeals court in Chicago that could hear this case, that there's been sort of a change of heart in terms of the way that they look at voter ID. We'll see if that's reflected in any decisions as this thing moves.
A change of heart on account of what?
Just as more evidence has come out, mm-hmm. It was Judge Posner on the Seventh Circuit who said, and he's somebody who authored the court decision out of the Seventh Circuit that upheld Indiana's voter ID law. And Judge Posner had mentioned that, you know, as the evidence has come out, he's looked at the issue differently and that, you know, it sort of signaled that future voter ID challenges might be looked at through a different lens.
Is it at all odd or inappropriate for the federal attorney general, the U.S. attorney general, to step in to a state level issue such as this?
Well, it seems like Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen thinks it's inappropriate for Eric Holder to step into a state level issue, but I don't think it's all that unusual. I mean, I think the Department of Justice gets involved in these cases from time to time. It's a little more unusual in that the Department of Justice's authority when it comes to voting laws used to be more focused on southern states. Or states, I guess, with when the Voting Rights Act was initially passed, states that had more of a history of discrimination. So those were the Section 5 states, they were called. So this is a little bit different in that regard. But as far as the DOJ, the U.S. DOJ getting involved in cases, that's kind of their prerogative.
And have we heard any reaction yet from the ACLU?
I have not heard a reaction yet from the ACLU. I'm sure they'd be happy to have the Department of Justice on their side here. This is not something where it's just the Wisconsin ACLU versus the Attorney General, though. They really do have quite, a cadre of attorneys who are working on this from national interest groups. I mean, there's a lot of big firms who have attorneys working with the ACLU on this on a pro bono basis. So I think they'll be happy to have more help, but it's not like they're lacking for help right now.
Mm-hmm. So what do you have a sense of what could happen next?
I think what happens next is we wait for the appeal process to move forward. It's probably not going to move all that quickly. And we have other cases that are going to move quickly. There's a lot of cases in the pipeline right now for example, the gay marriage lawsuit. That's something that the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals has said they're going to hear oral arguments on that in August. So that one's moving very quickly. Mm-hmm. This one, possibly not so much because you don't have the same circumstances. And the gay marriage issue, you have states all over the country where these lawsuits are popping up, very similar lawsuits everywhere. And so these courts of appeals are trying to expedite the appeals, get them to the Supreme Court, which is going to make the final call on this. I don't know what's going to happen on voter ID, but I think it's a different issue.
Sean, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, joining us from the state capitol.
It's time for our weekly look at Congress with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Congress has just 11 workdays left before the August recess, and while the influx of young immigrants at the border is being called a crisis, a compromise on immigration seems elusive.
Meanwhile, Democrats in the Senate and Republicans in the House are working on issues that are not expected to make any progress. For Democrats, it's legislation that would undo the Supreme Court's recent Hobby Lobby ruling, and for Republicans, it's a hearing on their plan to sue President Obama for delaying the Affordable Care Act's employer mandate.
Paul Singer joins us every week at this time. Paul, good to have you back.
Nice to be with you, Rob. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
All right.
Well,
waiting for them to leave.
Yeah, this immigration thing now, we've talked about this a lot in the past months. You've said probably nothing is going to happen in this session of Congress. The issue is heating up. All these youth from Central America on the border, more people in polls rating immigration as a top issue. What are both sides pushing for? Is there any room for real compromise?
Yeah, well, now we've moved off the issue of an actual immigration bill that sort of, alters, amends, or changes federal law. Mm. Now what we're into is a very narrow piece of legislation to provide emergency funding to a bunch of agencies to respond to the crisis of these unaccompanied children flowing across the border. They've had something like 40 or 50,000 kids from Central America turning themselves in at the border, essentially looking for asylum in the U.S. And it's basically overwhelming the system. And so President Obama's asked for $3.7 billion, I believe, of kind of emergency funding to handle these kids, send a bunch of judges and lawyers down there to process them and send them back. The Republicans have said essentially, well, if you're going to get any extra money, we want a change in law that will allow you to basically deport them much more quickly. Mm. There's a whole bunch of technical reasons why, under existing law, you can basically grab a kid or any illegal immigrant at that point and just send them back to across the border if they come from Mexico or Canada.
Right.
If they come from somewhere further away, you got to go through this whole process. And basically, the Republicans want to streamline that to get rid of these kids faster. We'll see. The White House has said they're interested in some similar law change, so it may not be an unbridgeable gap.
So the White House said they might be open to a faster send back without the full process that some Republicans are looking for?
Yeah, some version of that. That's right. The administration is willing to, in fact, at one point was going to ask for themselves a change to that law to sort of expand it so that other children from other Central American countries could be deported more quickly, similarly to the way it's done for Mexican children. Again, the issue is you got these two parties that don't trust each other. Can they actually come to a deal? The Republicans still say they don't believe the Obama administration is going to implement this stuff the way they mean for him to. And they're very concerned that essentially what's going on is, with a wink, the administration is going to let these kids ultimately stay. They'll get some sort of asylum declaration that will let these kids stay. And that has been a concern of a lot of the Republican members.
Are they balking at the price tag here of $3.7 billion? I know Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin joins us on our show today. He's been saying lately it'd be a lot cheaper if we just did what we want to do, ship them back faster. We can do it at something like a tenth of the cost.
Right. Well, there's some balking at the cost, but I don't think the cost is really the big deal. Ultimately, it's going to be a couple of billion dollars one way or the other. I don't think it's going to be, the $300 million that Senator Johnson may be suggesting. But, there's going to be more money. It'll probably be less money than Obama is asking for. And I don't think anybody really disputes the notion that the agencies that are responding to this flood of kids need more money. And even just to house them, and to provide more judges down there to process them. You just don't have enough people on the ground. So then the issue is going to become how much money, and that's still sort of up for dispute as well. They still think they're going to be able to get this done sometime in the next couple of weeks. We'll see.
Election year political calculations here?
Sure. For everybody. One of the things that's interesting is that the idea of deporting these kids more quickly was something that the Obama administration had floated by themselves and immediately got a pushback from immigration advocates and for immigrant rights groups. Who still, will argue that Obama has, in fact, been setting historic records of deportation, despite the fact that he has rewritten some policies to make it easier for some kids to stay. So it's very tough. And, of course, I think ultimately nobody wants to look like we are simply turning our back on some kids who are coming from very, very rough circumstances and have been through a very traumatic experience. I think there is still, on both sides, an effort to extend as much humanitarian care as possible, even while upholding our immigration laws.
So that's something that might get accomplished in the next 10, 11 days. There's some legislation you're less or more skeptical about. Very justifiably, we heard just a little while ago that a Democratic Senate plan to turn around the Supreme Court's ruling, in effect, turn it around to the Hobby Lobby lawsuit on contraceptive coverage under the Affordable Care Act. That's already been stifled within the Senate, hasn't it?
Yes. Which came as no surprise to anybody. These are the sort of things, and I know you and I have talked about this before on this program, that we would call them message votes. You know, the Democrats wanted to make a point. The point being, we disagree with the Supreme Court, and we believe the Supreme Court has narrowed women's right to contraception, because the way this ruling works is it says that privately held companies can refuse to pay for some forms of contraception that refuse to provide insurance that covers some forms of contraception that they consider a violation of their religious tenets. So what the senators were trying to do was to pass a law that basically patches that, or a fix, as they were calling it, that would say, no, you have to provide, you know, all legal contraception. Your health insurance plan has to provide all legal contraception for your employees. You can't choose, as it were.
But even if it had somehow gotten through the Senate, wasn't going to go anywhere in the House.
Not a chance.
So this is a political messaging bill.
Yeah, and it's actually good. The funny thing about this one, it's good political messaging for both sides. Democrats can now go out and say, see, we tried to reinstate your right to choose and your right to contraception, and the Republicans blocked it. And the Republicans go out and say, see, the Democrats are trying to overturn your religious freedoms and force this, you know, whatever, contraception sort of thing down your throat. So, you know, both sides win. The only thing that, you know, it doesn't change any policy anywhere. No laws get passed.
And speaking of laws not getting passed, a lawsuit against President Obama, that's the effort from Republicans on the House side of things.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of that. I really don't. It's we thought originally they were going to sue Obama on the basis of, a bunch of executive action he's been taking. Because he's been saying, I'm going to act without Congress. Ultimately, they boiled it down to one item, and that is Obama delaying the employer mandate to provide coverage under the Affordable Care Act. The thing is that, I mean, this is something that the Republicans had been asking for. They had wanted a bill passed to delay the mandate in the first place. So then Obama does it unilaterally, and now they're going to sue him for essentially not implementing the law. They apparently had a witness this afternoon testifying on this who explained why they could sue Obama for this, who had previously written an op-ed sometime earlier arguing they could not sue Obama for this. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what to make of it. It seems to me it is a long shot at best and a bit of a stunt.
One more thing we've talked about, I don't want to leave it behind, the Highway Trust Fund, long-term problem with how we pay for federal road maintenance. Something's going to get passed, but not the big thing.
Yeah, Congress will kick the can down the road, as they are good at doing. The House has passed a bill that will just basically extend the current trust fund through May. I believe the Senate's going to vote on another version of that probably early next week. And everybody will just harumph and pass the thing. The whole notion being that this gives us more time to work out a bigger deal, which, of course, is not really the truth. The truth is this will get us time to get past the elections and decide whether we're in better position to force our hand.
Do you know if states are complaining on this? Because they're probably trying to make long-term plans based around this funding.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is Congress hearing it, do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. I mean, the argument they get from just about everybody is that these 5, 6, 7 month extensions don't really help anybody very much, because you can't plan for next year's construction season if your money's going to run out in May. You know, you guys up in Wisconsin, I doubt you've even moved a shovel by May. I mean, you probably start in June and July.
Well, depends on the year, but it can happen.
Yeah, and you may not at this point. There may not be any guarantee of money.
So some kind of short-term agreement looks very likely, though?
Yeah. Because otherwise the thing runs out, the trust fund runs out in like August, and that would be bad for everybody running into an election season.
All right, Paul, thanks as always for joining us.
Sure, we'll talk to you soon, Rob.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us this time every week to bring us up to date on the latest from Congress and the election politics relating thereto. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin joins us now. Even as midterm elections bring a renewed focus to domestic issues like the economy and health care, conflicts and crises around the globe and at our border are dominating the headlines.
Senator Johnson is a member of both the Senate Foreign Relations and Homeland Security Committees, and his recent comments on the immigration debate have attracted national attention.
Senator Johnson, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, Cynthia. Hello, Rob. How are you doing?
Really good. How are you today?
Real good.
Well, as we mentioned, your comments have been in the news lately on immigration. Just 11 days left, working days until the August recess in Congress, trying to deal with this, what's being called a crisis of Central American youth on our border. Now, you've criticized the amount of money the president is asking for. You say a lot cheaper to send kids back home by plane. How would this repatriation fast approach deal with the immigration debate?
Well, first, let me say, I think we all agree what we are dealing with here is a humanitarian crisis, and we're a compassionate society, and we should and we will deal with those 57,000 unaccompanied children on the border with real compassion. But we also need to be concerned about and show compassion to the children currently in Central America whose parents just might be deciding right now, or somebody that they know might be deciding to pay $3,000 or $4,000 or $5,000 to some of the most evil people in the world, these human traffickers, these drug runners and smugglers, making that decision to pay that money to put their children on that train called the Beast, or subject them to that journey where, you know, so many are being sexually assaulted, potentially murdered. And so, you know, from my standpoint, we really have to properly diagnose the problem and establish what our primary goal should be here, and our goal should be to stop the flow. Secretary Johnson of the Department of Homeland Security testified that we're at 57,000 now. He testified that we could be to 90,000 just by the end of this fiscal year, which means September 30th, a couple months from now. And we've seen other estimates that by 2015 that number could exceed 100,000. So we need to stop the flow. We don't want to increase those numbers. And one of the things driving this illegal immigration for years is America has provided incentives for illegal crossing. And so we had a 2008 well-intentioned bill on human trafficking that Dianne Feinstein put in an amendment that really gave all kinds of additional rights to children in Central America, basically slowed down the process of returning them to their country of origin. And then we had President Obama, of course, issue his memorandum. I don't think he had the constitutional authority to do so, but, you know, deferred action on childhood admissions, which basically communicated to people in Central America, boy, send your kids up to America. If they get to the promised land, they're home free. And so, you know, my objection to the $3.7 billion, or put another way, $3,700 million, is we're just creating added incentive. And if we spend that money to disperse kids around America, we're just, again, affirming the fact that if you come into America illegally, you're going to be able to stay here, and we need to, you know, eliminate or at least drastically reduce those incentives for illegal crossing.
The president is also looking to spend money in the countries of origin here, among other things, to try to send the message that kids will not necessarily be taken into the country, to try to help with the economy, to try to help with violence and gangs in those countries. Is that a good strategy?
Well, he's allocating about $295 billion out of that $3.7 billion for that purpose. But I guess I would ask, you know, we haven't done a particularly good job of shoring up our own economy, providing economic security to America, or ending drug violence here in America. So what makes us think that we spend $295 million and we can stem violence and improve economies in Central America? I think that's just a pipe dream. If you want to deter parents from sending their kids, the best deterrence really would be to have planes of kids, again, done very safely with great humanity, return those children so that the parents or anybody thinking about spending $5,000 will just realize that's just going to be a waste of money, because if you get into our country illegally, you're going to be sent right back. So don't spend the money. Don't endanger your children. That has got to be the number one deterrence. We had a hearing in Homeland Security, and, you know, I think it was the Justice Department or might have been Border Patrol. One of the agencies had these nice posters, showing a barren desert, and a marketing campaign to try and deter people. And we should do certainly broadcast the reality situation, but the reality situation should be that you're not going to be able to stay in America. And right now, the reality situation is they're being allowed to stay in America. So we've got to end that dynamic. We've got to end those incentives.
One objection to that is that some of these youth, who knows what percentage, might genuinely qualify as refugees due to risk of violence, human rights abuses, being forced into gangs or prostitution. They might really qualify as refugees. And if we send them back without going through the process, we don't know.
Sure. Well, there's a way to legally claim asylum, and it generally starts in your country of origin. You go to the U.S. Embassy, the U.S. Consulate, and you tell your story and you try and gain access that way. Listen, there are 7 billion people in the world. There are hundreds of millions that living in real destitution, and I think we're a compassionate society. We want every human being to have the opportunity to build a good life for themselves or family, but the fact of the matter is we have to control our borders. We're a nation of laws. We have to have people respect that, and we certainly have to control the flow of legal immigration. So we should really fix our legal immigration system. We should have a robust guest worker program so people can come into the appropriate number of people can come into our country legally a lot easier than we make it now. But we cannot tolerate illegal immigration. We certainly can't have borders that are utterly out of control, not only from a standpoint of the humanitarian crisis it's creating, but also from a standpoint of national security. We don't know what terrorists may be coming in because we haven't secured the border, as well as the health aspects. We are getting drug-resistant strains of tuberculosis being carried in the country. So there are all kinds of dangerous aspects to this. But, a top priority of the federal government is national defense and securing and protecting the borders of your country. And we're one of the few nations that simply don't do that, and we have to start.
Talking to U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, if you want to join in and ask a question and give your thoughts on immigration and the current border crisis, or we'll be moving on to foreign policy in a little bit, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Reed is already on the line in Clintonville. We'll bring him on the air now. Reed, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for this opportunity. Senator Johnson, I have two questions for you. The first is, what happens to these children once the planes land back in Guatemala or Colombia or wherever they might be returned to, when their parents or relatives of any relationship do not come to the airport to meet them? How do we deal with that sort of issue? And I'm sure that would be a major aspect of loading planes with hundreds of children at a time. Secondly, I would ask you why you singled out Dianne Feinstein and President Obama in your previous comment without making any reference whatsoever to President George Bush, who had a great deal to do with the immigration policy when he was in office.
And Reed, thanks for the call. Senator Johnson?
Well, first of all, when I talk about dealing with those children with real humanity and compassion, I think if we're going to spend money, we should spend it on facilities down in those home countries, potentially contributing to their immigration services so that, again, there's an opportunity if there are real hardship cases there and there's a legitimate claim for asylum, we should do that. But, a legitimate claim for asylum isn't just because you don't have a high standard of living or not as high as in the U.S. because, again, there are literally billions of people throughout the world that don't, and we simply can't have completely open borders. The reason I mentioned Dianne Feinstein, it was her amendment that really created, all of the legal protections, which, again, I'm not opposed to legal protections, but we have to understand it was those legal protections that really did pretty well tie government's hands in terms of actually returning Central American children to their home country. So they're all staying, which again creates that incentive for more people to come. And you just have to do a root cause analysis here. If we want to stop the flow, and I would say that is got to be our goal of policy. We don't want to see another 50,000, another 100,000 of these unaccompanied children being sent here. But as long as we incentivize it, that's what's going to happen.
Thanks to Reed for the call. Before I go back to caller Senator Johnson, this issue is coming home to Wisconsin very literally. Requests evidently from the federal government to look for sites to at least temporarily house some of these youth on the border in Madison and Milwaukee. Your response to that?
Well, we are hearing news reports of that. We have not in our office heard from this administration they have any plans to do that. We're monitoring that closely. But again, I think that just speaks to the entire issue. If we disperse these children, if we move them away from the border, or if we don't send them back, if we disperse them around America, I mean, that's pretty much a tacit admission that we're not going to send them home. I mean, that's what they're being told. They get this notice to appear, but they're viewing that as a permission slip to stay. And that's really what the drug cartels are telling those children, those parents back in Guatemala and Central America. So if we disperse them around America, the fact is they're not being sent back. They won't be sent back. So the reality situation is exactly what the drug cartel is telling those kids, which, again, incentivizes more to come. Our goal needs to be to stop the flow.
Back to our callers now with Chris on the line in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi, nice to meet you.
What did you want to bring up, Chris?
I'm looking at a similar situation that would have happened about 50 years ago, 50, 60 years ago right now. And we were taking in immigrants that were sometimes coming over illegally during the Holocaust. And this was very obviously a humanitarian crisis that was being faced with genocide. They obviously didn't have the Jewish people being forced into prostitution or drug cartels that are happening in Central and South America. But it's a very similar thing that we would have been. Our future generations and other societies across the globe will judge us based on the decisions that we make right now. We have to make the morally responsible one to provide relief to children who are sometimes young enough that they would not be considered unaccompanied minors within the United States flights. If a parent is sending their 4-year-old, 5-year-old child into the United States unaccompanied, that's not a decision that's been made lightly. It's a decision that's been made as a last resort.
Chris, thanks for the call. Senator Johnson, a moral obligation to help these kids more than just sending them back to their families, she says.
Again, America's a very compassionate society. We're a nation of immigrants. We need to value that fact. We need a functioning legal immigration system. And there is a way, what should have happened 56 years ago, what should be happening now is individuals should be seeking a legal path to America. I mean, do it the right way, not do it illegally. We just can't abide by this lawlessness. We can't. Again, you're seeing the crisis that's being put in the border by 57,000. If we open up the floodgates, we'd be talking about hundreds of thousands, if not millions more. And so I keep going back to the overall goal is we have to secure our border. But the way you secure the border, we may have to put more resources there. We may have to build better fencing. I've been down there. The fencing really is pretty minimal. Someplace it doesn't exist, maybe more agents. But in general, the way you secure the border is you eliminate all the incentives for illegal immigration, which, let me add another one. In the Senate immigration bill, one of the reasons I voted against that, it included $262 billion of basically benefits for non-U.S. citizens. We've made all these promises to U.S. citizens that we don't have the capability of paying for over the next 30 years. We can't afford to offer benefits to non-U.S. citizens. Again, that's just another one of those incentives. So, I agree with Chris. This has been a bipartisan problem over administrations, both Democratic and Republican. We have refused. We've been unable to secure the border, which is one of the reasons Americans aren't trusting of a comprehensive approach that includes border security, because they've been promised that in the past. America has never secured the border, and so they don't have any faith that they will do it this time. So from my standpoint, we need to first secure the border. But again, let me point out, it's about eliminating the incentives for illegal immigration. That is the number one thing we do, which means you need a functioning legal immigration system, a guest worker program. Let's not send the brightest people we educate here in America back to their home countries where they develop businesses and innovate in those countries. Let's let them innovate and make American economy stronger. So there are a lot of things that I think we can agree on. And we should concentrate on what we can agree on. Hopefully we'll agree on the overall goal is we need to stop the influx.
We're speaking with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson covering the immigration so far. We're going to turn to foreign affairs, the Middle East and elsewhere coming up.
What questions do you have for Senator Johnson? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're back with U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, and we're talking about ongoing crises and conflicts around the world and at our border.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Your thoughts on U.S. foreign policy, especially in the Middle East, 800-642-1234. Senator Johnson, the big news today or this week, Israel, Gaza. Rockets launched from Gaza into Israel, bombs from Israel into the Gaza Strip. The latest we're hearing is that Israel has again agreed to a short ceasefire, waiting for a response from Hamas. Looking at this from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, what would you like to see the United States do here, if anything?
Well, what I'd like to see is Hamas to do is stop sending rockets into Israel and recognize Israel's right to exist. I mean, that has been the big stumbling block. I think Israel has shown repeatedly that they want peace and they're willing to really go to great lengths and negotiate an awful lot of way to obtain peace. They just don't have a willing negotiating partner. So I've always been concerned when America forces or puts an undue amount of pressure on Israel to enter into peace agreements with a partner like Hamas, and quite honestly, the Palestinian Authority that has just never recognized Israel's right to exist. I don't know how you get over that table stake concession on your negotiating partner in the peace process where the other side just refuses the fact that refuses that you even have the right to exist. So again, from my standpoint, peace in the Middle East really can be achieved immediately by just Hamas laying down its arms. Stop rocketing Israel. Take a look at what Israel has done in terms of growth in the economy and providing prosperity for its people. I wish the other Arab lands, the other dictatorships in that region would just look and say, we could actually have strong economies and have opportunities for our people to have build a good life for themselves or family if we follow the example of an Israel rather than try and wipe them off the face of the earth.
A sticking point from the Palestinian side has been objections to Israeli settlements. Palestinians say they've been violating previous international agreements on that issue. Should that be on the table?
I think Israel's always put just about everything on the table. But again, I don't know how you can negotiate anything with somebody who doesn't recognize your right to exist. So until that happens, I just think, unfortunately, peace between Israel and the Palestinians is a pipe dream.
We'll go to a caller now. We've got Mark on the line in La Crosse. Mark, hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, Senator, are you as frustrated as I am with the coverage of all these issues that we have in the Middle East and even with Russia, that they don't go back and look at candidate Obama and look at the policies that he put in place when he backed off doing the missile defense in Eastern Europe, when he put all these policies in place that have just backfired on us completely as far as when we pulled out of Iraq, how we did it, how we approach it, how we approached all these other Middle Eastern countries where we sat back and weren't proactive. And they just don't go back and analyze all the things that have been done and the cause and the reaction of his policy and procedure that puts us in a situation that's far worse than if we would have taken the approach that the other candidates were touting that were going against him. What's your feeling on that?
Well, I always say that nobody can out-frustrate me. This is an incredibly frustrating place to be. Let me first start in terms of whose fault it is for these conflicts. I mean, it's Vladimir Putin's, it's Bashar Assad, it's Al-Qaeda. It's those are the people who are responsible for all this conflict. But that being said, the fact is America is the world superpower. If we refuse to lead, greater vacuums, greater voids get created in the world, and very bad people fill those voids. And there are things we can do. We can provide stability. President Obama's, and I think his greatest historic blunder, strategic blunder, was in bugging out of Iraq. He came into that situation, into the presidency, with Iraq largely stable. His job was to improve stability, maintain it or improve it. And the only way that was going to happen is if we did what we did in Europe and in Germany and Japan and South Korea. We left a stabilizing force. I don't think we'd be facing what appears to be the breakup of Iraq, the establishment of what the Wall Street Journal calls Al-Qaeda-stan in Syria and Iraq. So there are things that America can do, things we can't do. But in the end, I really do blame the evildoers, people like Assad and Putin and Osama bin Laden. Those are the real people to blame.
But how long do you leave forces in a place like Iraq to maintain stability? I mean, would you say we should have had a force there for decades to come?
Well, you know, possibly, but then you say, okay, well, that's going to cost a lot of money. Well, what does it cost us when we see this level of instability, when we see the world going up in flames in so many different places? You know, we buried our head in the sand when Al-Qaeda declared war on us in the 90s, and as a result, the Twin Towers came down. So we simply can't ignore these problems, or they will continue to fester, and they will eventually come home to our shores. You know, the spread of Al-Qaeda, the metastasizing of it, is a real threat to our national security. We ignore it at our own peril. We ignored it in the 90s. We got 9/11. And if we continue to ignore it, I think the cost is going to be far greater than if we would have just maintained a stabilizing force in Iraq, which could have done so much good. We would have prevented overflights of Iran supplying Syria. Who knows how much stability we could have provided had we stayed there, but we didn't. And that was just, I think, a huge strategic blunder, and we're paying the cost for that blunder.
One more foreign policy issue I want to get to before we're done. Some new news from Benghazi this week. One of the suspects in the 2012 terrorist attack turned up dead. A month ago, U.S. forces captured a man viewed as a ringleader of the attack. Republicans in the House still investigating the events surrounding the attack. What are you still hoping comes out of that?
Well, I hope we do bring the people to justice. It is, from my standpoint, pretty sad that it's taken so long. We've known who these people are. I think we probably have the wherewithal to do it, but we haven't. But again, I don't know all the specifics, so we need to bring people to justice. We also need to hold people accountable for a tragedy that I don't think ever should have happened. I think just a small, fully armed security force in Benghazi, and that really was the dereliction duty of Secretary Clinton, Secretary of State Clinton. This tragedy, four Americans didn't have to die, and those people need to be held accountable as well.
Senator Johnson, thank you as always for joining us.
Have a great day.
You too. That's Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. By the way, tomorrow we'll be talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin from here in Wisconsin, not on foreign policy, on some health care issues, including what's going on here in the state.
Coming up next, a Wisconsin teenager and her mom are headed to the White House this week to meet with the First Lady. She was the Wisconsin winner in a national kids recipe contest.